Okay, welcome everybody to Concurrent Session 2D. My name is Andrew Gale and I'm the chair for this session. The topic for this session is when too much capital is not enough, capital in a mutual health fund. The presenter for this topic is Peter Carroll. Peter's paper is available on the convention website and I hope that most of you had a chance to download it and read it prior to coming along today. Peter will be well known to many of you. He's had an extensive and varied consulting career, and he has the distinction of being one of the first trailblazing actuaries who commenced working in the health insurance field when it was considered wider fields more than 20 years ago. During this time, he's been a constant contributor to the development of health insurance actuarial practice. He's the appointed actuary for a mutual health insurer, and this paper expands on some ideas he developed during a recent period as the wonderfully titled Actuary in Residence at Macquarie University. Now, just a reminder to you that this session is being recorded and I understand will be loaded onto the Institute's website after the convention. So I'll now hand over to Peter to make his presentation, and then I'm sure we'll have an opportunity for questions, comments and discussion. Thank you, Peter.
Oh, thank you, Andrew, and thanks for clapping it before I've done anything. It saves you doing it at the end and probably wouldn't want to. Yes, I am old and I've been around a long time and all that sort of stuff, but I'm so old I actually enjoy coming to these conventions now because I don't feel any sense of responsibility whatsoever. I can say anything I like and nobody's going to get upset about it. I want to acknowledge a few things first of all. Phil Latham told me this morning that they went through the list of members of the Institute to see how many mentioned health insurance as one of their practice areas, and it is over 200 actuaries who mention health insurance now as part of their practice. And I just can't believe it. I mean, when I first got involved 25 years ago, Dave Watson and Brent Walker were pretty much it. I want to acknowledge all this, the fraternal group of health actuaries who have been sustained me over 20 years involved in this industry. I also want to thank Macquarie University, who's invited me to be actuary in residence. I don't actually reside there. But and many, many years ago, they used to have an artist in residence when I was officially on their payroll. And this person used to leave sort of lumps of iron lying around the campus and called it essence of BHP or something, you know, and paint graffiti on the wall and stuff like that. And the students used to mock it, you know, in various ways. And the notion that they'd have an actuary in residence was so attractive to me. I thought, you know, I'll be able to mix with all these artists now. And they'll actually think I'm, you know, sort of an interesting person. Was so attractive that I said, yeah, I'll do it. And then came the cost. That was the benefit. The cost was, yes, you have to give a seminar, Peter. And so I thought, oh, what on earth? So I thought capital in a mutual, and this is how this paper started. And I thank Pierre Dejong and Dr. Sashi Pakal, who's come here today, who's also taking up some of these ideas and has received a research grant from the Institute to pursue some of the ideas that I've, in my amateur way, have put forward in this paper. Lastly, I'd like to acknowledge Andrew, who, again, apart from being a great friend and supporter and a mutual chewer of the cud about health insurance matters over many, many years, agreed and contributed greatly to, might agree to review and contributed greatly to the paper with some of the ideas, not all of which I accepted, but much of which made me think. And there's a lot more that can be said and done. In particular, he looked at the relationship between pricing, mutuality, capital, and so on. And I haven't done anything in my paper about pricing. So there's a whole lot more stuff there. Okay, to move on to this, this technology always bamboozles me, but I'm going to try. No, how do I make it go on? Yes, good. I'm actually opposed to the use of PowerPoint, but they forced me this time to do it. So I'd much rather walk out there and just talk, but you're all plugged into PowerPoint now. They're going to have these conventions on Facebook soon, I know, and we won't have to come along at all. But anyway, Bill Gates has got me this time. So I've actually got some PowerPoint slides, as they call them at Macquarie, where it's compulsory. You must use PowerPoint or they fire you. So I'm going to take an economist's view of this topic, and it was stimulated partly by the notion that the regulator said after the GFC that all health funds ought to have a capital management plan. So all the directors and all the health funds all started saying things like, what do I mean, a capital management plan? And what do we have to do? And I, being actually an actuary to one of these funds, was asked this question. So I had to think about it. And, as I quote one of the people in my paper, as soon as you try and define something that you think you know, you realise how vague your ideas are. And so it's a sort of bit of an intellectual effort involved in trying to define them down. So that's what started me thinking about this. And then I realised that mutuals and for-profit or shareholder-driven institutions are very different in the way they think about capital and manage capital and the role that capital plays in them. They're similar in some ways too. And I needed to tease this out in my own thinking. And, of course, the directors of the fund that I advise were interested in these ideas too, and they're very much in the mutual tradition. So I'm approaching the topic through the eyes of a mutual. And, of course, capital itself, and I do rehearse a bit of this in the paper, I'm not going to spend much time on it now, capital, the thinking around capital in what is a cash flow industry with no actuarial funding at all. It's just money in, money out, pay-as-you-go industry, health insurance in Australia. It's basically a substitute, if you go back to the history, for a national health insurance scheme. That's how it originally grew up. So it's not didn't come out of the private enterprise insurance market at all. In that context, the way that people thought about capital has changed. And if you go back 30 years, I quote a couple of examples in the paper, and Andrew drew my attention particularly to this. I was aware that there were no minimum capital standards in the industry, but I wasn't aware that there were limits on the maximum capital that funds could have to the degree that there clearly were. And when you go back and actually look, and the Department of Health, before there was a distinct financial regulator, actually forced funds to divest themselves of capital if they accumulated too much back in the 1960s and 70s. Well, those days have changed. I won't go through the history here because it is in the paper, but the end result we've got to is the situation now that's up on the slide. We have 10 for-profit funds in the market. Now, not all of them are pure shareholder-driven funds, but there are some that are, at least there's four that are, you could argue. Certainly NIB, everybody would acknowledge, it's quoted on the stock exchange and it answers to the capital market all the time, but there's three others. There's another six that are part of a mutual structure but are themselves for-profit funds, and all the Bupa Group are part of that. Their ultimate parent in the UK is a mutual, but nevertheless here in Australia they're a for-profit organisation. And Australian Unity is another example of that, and they have Grand United as well. They are part of a mutual friendly society, but the fund itself is a for-profit, with its shareholders are the rest of the group. Of course, Medibank Private has been demutualised and is a for-profit fund now. It not only pays dividends to the government, it pays tax as well. It's rather amusing to watch. Penny Wong wears one hat as the shareholder of Medibank Private. So I won't embarrass Andrew by asking him to say anything here, but his shareholder, on the one hand, is taking money out of Medibank Private, while on the other hand, Nicola Roxon is saying that, you know, we're looking after consumers and we're trying to keep prices down. It's kind of an interesting situation that they're in. And, of course, the other side of politics in Australia wants to sell it off completely. But anyway, Medibank Private's about a third of the market and Bupa is about another third of the market. So these big for-profits now cover 70% of all people that have health insurance, private health insurance in Australia, are members of a fund that's got for-profit status, and it can technically withdraw profits from the fund and pay it to the shareholders. And so the structure of the market is basically by premiums, 37% investor-driven, 30% not-for-profit, no investors at all, and 34% of the premiums are paid to funds that are in this hybrid situation where they're part of a group that's partly mutual and partly for-profit. Now, I actually think that structure's pretty healthy. I, in a previous life, fought politically, as a political animal, not as an actuary, against the demutualisation of the NRMA, for example, because it was the last mutual in the general insurance market in Australia. And I thought that was a bad thing, that there was no mutual whatever in the market. Of course, that happened some years ago also in life insurance. I think the healthiest insurance market is one that has a mixture of the Darwinistic, profit-driven, highly efficient, if you like, insurers on the one hand, and the woolly, soft, cuddly mutuals on the other, if you want to put it that way. And I think that gets the best outcomes in terms of, like, natural market forces encouraging equity and efficiency and so on. And in insurance, that matters a lot, in my opinion, because as soon as you become a claimant of an insurance company, you're a pariah, really, for all the other stakeholders. You're making a claim on the capital of that fund. And even if you're a continuing continuing policyholder that's not claiming, ultimately it's going to cost you. But certainly if you're an owner of capital looking for profits, once someone becomes a claimant, they're no longer of interest to you as a customer, really. Mutuals, to some extent, soften that. And that's, I think, the virtue that they have. And you sometimes see that. You see that in Queensland at the moment where, policyholders are using political efforts to try and encourage the insurance industry there to support the claimants. And I can remember when NRMA was still a mutual and there were floods in Wollongong, NRMA members marched in the streets and forced the directors of NRMA to take a more benign view. Now, whatever the merits of the particular case, I think that kind of force in the insurance market is healthy, in my view. So I'm actually quite pleased with the way that the private health insurance market has evolved structurally. So I come from that position. The major differentiator between the mutuals and the for-profits, of course, is capital. That's the principal difference between them, the way capital is subscribed, and therefore I think it's worth exploring that issue. Okay, now how do I make this go? Yes, could do it. Easy, just push. This is how they differ, in my view. They differ in their objectives, While for-profits have a variety of objectives, the dominant objective and the one that trumps all the others is the making of profits for their investors. Mutuals have a variety of objectives too, but making profits is not always the dominant one. The way the mutuals generally evolve is out of a political process in a community where for-profit providers of services are leaving gaps that they want to fill. And so that's how mutuals come. And often there's a politician involved. The NRMA, for example, I think it was Watson, was one of the early prime ministers of Australia, was the driving force in the establishment of the NRMA in the 1920s. And if you go back to the AMP Society, for example, go back to the 1850s in Australia, where it was in fact set up by citizens. In a form that wasn't fully legal, and they didn't to begin with, and they had to ultimately pass legislation to legalise it, because New South Wales was still subject to English law and the English Parliament. So, they come out of some political process in a community where there's such a powerful feeling that the for-profit providers or for-profit market is not catering to the full needs of the community, that they actually take action and set up an institution to cater to it. And the objectives are often philanthropical and social and so on. And the Friendly Society movement is another good example of this, where there was a social component as well as a purely financial component in the way in which it evolved in the 19th century in the UK. But so mutuals have this multiple objectives that go far beyond profit. Now, accessing capital, of course, that's obviously they get it differently. The investors subscribe capital in a for-profit. In a mutual, it's gradually accumulated through conservative financial practices over a period of time. Often the process is not smooth, it's lumpy. You know, the mutual does very well and it tucks away that big profit that it made in the stock market that year or on a property deal or whatever. But generally speaking, a long, gradual process of conservative management is how the capital accumulates, and it's hard won, the capital in a mutual, so it's not, you know, it's not readily given away for that reason. The accountability for capital, I mean, this is the problem that many mutuals have, is of course that occasionally a director gets a rush of blood to the head and they've got all this capital and they think, oh yes, wouldn't it be a good idea to develop a software company or something, you know, and off they go. And I think some health funds have been known to do this in the past, and some of the demutualisations that have happened have been the outcome of this sort of behaviour by directors. But that's the biggest problem, is that the directors, it's very hard to hold the directors accountable for their use of capital. And quite often they get captured by the sales force, as happened in the life insurance industry, for example, or by some other stakeholder group, and they serve their interests. But ultimately they are accountable to the customers that buy the products. Now, when you have a structure such as we now have, where there's competition by all these different types of companies, shareholder and whatever, I think you're much more likely to have the mutuals behave much more rationally in their use of capital. So I think that's... but nevertheless, they're not as directly accountable as a for-profit. Of course, they also differ in the way they use profits. Mutuals tend to tuck the profits away or to use them to lower prices or to enhance benefits or to engage in some other activity. I'm familiar, and Gail would be familiar too, I notice. Gail Ganane, a former CEO of FIAC, is here today. And early 90s, there was a fund with which I was associated that twice tried to go belly up by giving its capital back to its policyholders by by not increasing its prices sufficiently, and slight misjudgments, and it nearly ran out of capital altogether in a market that was highly volatile in terms of the benefits. And of course, health funds have this; they have massive cash flows in and out. Their premiums coming in, and their benefits going out, and you know, and the difference between them on $100 of cash flow might be $3 or $4 or $5, and it doesn't take much change in the behaviour of hospitals or doctors or whatever to cause that $5 to disappear very rapidly. And it, you don't have to run a health fund with very little capital for very long at a loss for it to be at risk of going out of business altogether. And part of the process of the regulator in health insurance has been to facilitate this orderly process of funds going out of business from time to time. And they were doing it at the rate of one every second year through most of my career. I think that's slowed down a bit now. But mutuals use their profits to enhance their value proposition, basically, given their multiple objectives, whereas shareholders in for-profit companies expect dividends and a return on their capital. So they're different in that way. They're also similar, though, in some ways. What I call the supply-side constraints, the technology with which you run a health insurer involves managing risk, and there's a whole range of risks, and I identify and list many of them in my paper. It's the same whether you're a mutual or a for-profit. You basically face the same supply-side technology issues and managing the risks, the whole range of risks that any enterprise is engaged in, and that insurance enterprises particularly are engaged in, and those that are engaged in dealing with financial instruments are engaged in. There's a whole variety of risks there, and both of them need capital for that purpose. In the case for for-profit, the capital doesn't necessarily have to be on the balance sheet. It can be elsewhere in the group and readily accessible. In a mutual, there's only one place it can be, and that's on your balance sheet, or it's not there, basically. There are devices like subordinated loans that are occasionally used, but they're not very satisfactory, and not too many people are prepared to lend money to an enterprise that needs it to support its balance sheet on a subordinated loan basis. So they're subject basically to the same supply-side constraints, and, of course, they're subject to the same regulation in our market, with one exception, I might say. And that one exception is that the regulator still tends to look in a jaundiced way on a mutual accumulating capital, where, of course, it's just not an issue in the case for for-profit. If a for-profit's got a massive amount of capital on its balance sheet, the regulator would say, you know, wouldn't even look. But if a mutual does, the regulator will tend to look in a jaundiced way at that. But otherwise, they're subject to the same regulation. They also compete in the same markets, of course. Most consumers have no idea whether the health fund they're with is a for-profit or a mutual these days. And they just look at the value proposition, the premiums versus benefits or whatever that are being offered with. And if a mutual overprices its products in order to accumulate a lot of capital, then it will be subject to the normal sanctions of a retail market. And companies like iSelect, will take that into account in their recommendations. They also compete in the capital market, of course, as well, but not directly, but the NIB takeover of Geelong is a very good example of the capital market at work affecting the behaviour of a mutual. NIB made an attempt to take over. Well, it's made several takeover attempts, reputedly, Manchester Unity was supposedly one on their hit list at one point until they were acquired by HCF, for example. But they made an overt attempt to take over Geelong, and it was quite a bitter battle. And in the end, Geelong remained. Geelong's a small regional fund, quite successful, deep roots in the local community in Geelong, south of Melbourne. And in the end, they spurned the NIB offer, which was something like $2,000 per member, to give them their vote to take them over. And the members said, no, we don't want the $2,000. We want to stay as a mutual, but ultimately. So that's the capital market at work. Presumably, if the members of Geelong, I'm not speaking for them, I don't know the inside detail at all, only what I've read in the media, but presumably if the members of Geelong had thought that the directors of Geelong were misusing the capital of the institution, they would have voted otherwise, or they would have put pressure on the directors to accept the takeover, and would have taken the $2,000, which is, of course, what happened with the NRMA. The NRMA members did reputedly vote 75% to accept the demutualisation proposal that was put up, and they took the money and ran. Probably ran all the way to QBE or wherever. But so they are competing in the capital market too. So what's the role of the regulator in all of this? In my view, the prudential minima are an appropriate place for the regulator to set constraints. It averts risk and it protects consumers to ensure that people engaged in the insurance business do have enough money to manage their business a minimum amount. I also think that the regulator's involvement in governance of these institutions is a healthy thing too, because well-governed institutions are exposed to market forces. They report to their stakeholders. The stakeholders, if they're not happy with the directors, can get rid of them, replace them, hold them accountable, and so on. I've argued this for many years. I made a submission along these lines to the Industry Commission in 1996, personally. So, and I think that that's great. The regulators do that. When I was growing up as an actuarial student, the notion then was the concept of freedom with publicity, and I tend to default to that in my view as to what regulators ought to do. So I see the governance stuff as part of that that discipline. However, I believe that intervening in the day-to-day financial affairs of a company that's running perfectly well is not called for, and in particular restraining the way in which mutuals use capital is inappropriate, and I have made these views known in the past, but this paper, I guess, is saying that, look, conditions have changed even more. We now have this mixed structure in the market, and we now have this market competition in both the capital markets and the retail markets, and the regulators should trust the market far more and facilitate that market and not use direction or not constrain the prices of a mutual in order to force them to effectively dip into their capital. And I just want to, the last thing I want to say is a little story that makes the point about mutuals and their capital, I think. It's an actuary, me, for example, sitting in the barber shop, and a little boy comes in and says, can you spare any change? And the barber whispers to the actuary, this guy's really stupid. Just watch this. And he puts his hand in his pocket, takes out a big shiny $1 coin and a little $2 coin. And he says to the boy, take your pick. And the boy takes the $1 coin and runs off. And the barber says to the actuary, this guy, I mean, he does this every week. He comes in and it's the same story. He always takes the $1, not the $2. How crazy can you get? Anyway, the actuary says, yeah, seems pretty stupid. But a little bit later, the actuary is wandering away from the barbershop and he sees a little boy eating an ice cream out on the seat outside. And he goes up to him and he says, listen, mate, what's the story? Why do you take the $1 coin, not the $2 coin? He said, oh, that barber, he's the dumbest guy I know. The minute I take the $2 coin, he'll stop playing the game. And that's really the story of the mutual with the capital. They could give their capital away, but it's a short-term decision, and game over then. While they've got their capital, they can use it to support their competitive position in the market, and if conditions are appropriate, they can discount prices and they can enhance benefits in a way that gives them a much stronger competitive position against their for-profit competitors. There are some other issues involved in that, but they're in the paper, and I'm more interested in hearing what other comments people have to make now. Thank you very much.
Okay, well, that leaves us with quite a bit of time for some questions and comments, so hopefully you've been thinking as Peter's been speaking. If you've got a comment to make, could you please approach the microphone in the centre of the room and say your name at the start of your comments? Who'd like to go first?
Tori Gervasi from Bupa. I'm not sure, Peter, that I really understand where you stand with for-profit organisations. Yeah, for-profit organisations, yes, we do make a profit, but it's more about profit. In the long term, for-profit organisations are in there for the long game. They're in there to give a return on capital, and we do hold our capital on the balance sheet. If we expect the parent to put capital in, I don't think we're going to be around for much longer. So a for-profit organisation, just give you a picture about how Bupa operates. It's about growing the business, and growing the business, we operate in the competitive market, so it's about prices, and we manage that by doing our expenses and managing our provider contracting. So I just ask you, how do you see a mutual doing that better than a for-profit organisation?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Tori, I mean, you and I have had a sort of conversation around these lines, I know, but I actually think the for-profits are more likely to be efficient in the economic sense than a mutual because of their focus and because of their accountability and so on. And you could say that some of the things that mutuals do are kind of externalities, if you want to use the economist term, to the fundamental activity of the insurer. But I also note that Bupa is not, in fact, a pure for-profit. Its parent is a mutual, and it does have that cultural overlay, if you like, that mutuals have. I think the best way of explaining, I guess, my position is to compare, say, NIB as it is now. I'm not attacking anybody when I say this, but NIB as it is now with what it was, say, 15 years ago, and how its conduct has changed. And it's a predatory company now, you might say, and the way in which it develops its products is clearly being done with one eye to the shareholder stakeholder, and it's constantly subject to comment and questioning and goal setting and so on in the capital market, where the chief executive is constantly discussing the strategy of the company and exposing it to public scrutiny on the stock exchange. Now, I think, and again, it's nothing pejorative in what I'm saying, but I just think it's a different form of behaviour. Now, I think mutuals do have the opportunity, as I show the algebra of it, to subsidise their prices by accumulating capital. And because that capital is what Reddington called the free estate, it's not associated with any particular liabilities. It doesn't have to be matched in the Reddington sense, or immunised in the Reddington sense. It can be invested in a relatively free way, and in a risky way, for high returns in the long term. And they can be used to subsidise either benefits or prices without, in fact, diminishing the capital strength of the company, just by using the investment earnings and without the demand of the capital stakeholders who want a return on their capital investment. In a sense, the consumers of the organisation are getting dividends on the capital that's been subscribed. Now, another way in which I think they're different is there's a kind of paternalistic view, almost, one might say, I don't know whether that's a sexist term these days, but there's a view that managing a mutual is rather like managing a family trust, where you somewhere like the Rockefellers, or presumably, where you inherit this wealth from the previous generation, you use it for the benefit of the current generation of people, without diminishing it and without weakening it, and then you pass it on intact to the next generation. And there's a sense in a mutual of doing that. Whereas I would imagine in a for-profit, if somebody came along and made a good enough offer that the shareholders might do well out of, not talking about customers, not talking about future generations or previous generations or whatever, then it would be a purely financial decision, ultimately. If that capital that's being used in Bupa, not to say Bupa's not a good one, but in NIB, if the capital that's being used in NIB could be better employed by those stakeholders that own that capital by investing in widgets or whatever, then it would be just, they would close the business down or sell it off and to somebody else, and away they'd go. So I think this is a different, how can I put it, a different sense of culture or atmosphere. The notion that they talk about in a mutual is the bond. If you've ever been involved in credit unions, they talk about, credit unions have economic advantage for various reasons. One is that they get a much lower default rate on lending than a for-profit institution in the same space would have, because there's a sense that you're borrowing off your colleague at work or your neighbour down the street, and you're saving your money to help your neighbour down the street with the credit union. There's this bonded idea. Of course, they also get... Yes, I love you too. I'm in the middle of giving a presentation, Grant, so I have to call you back. Cheers, mate. That's my partner.
No, it's not.
Okay, Brent.
Yeah.
It's good we have a diverse world, because I guess I've thought about capital in a totally different way than you have. The main reason why health insurers started up and presumably will start up in the future is to provide a service. And that service is an insurance service. It's a smoothing service, if you like, to ensure that people, most people or all people that are insured, can afford to their future medical costs. I was listening right through your presentation for the word service, and maybe it came out, but it didn't come out in the context that I was thinking it would come out. And the second issue that the second word I really wanted to hear was risk, because as soon as an insurer or any organisation and an institution starts providing a service that involves the smoothing of costs across a population, there becomes some significant risks involved, and it's how those risks are managed, including using capital to manage them, that determines the amount of capital that an organisation requires. Now, if you're a for-profit, you can afford to take I'll step back a bit. If you're for-profit, then the directors of the for-profit organisation have a different risk requirement. You know, their view of risk is different because they know that they can get the capital. You know, if they make a misjudgment, they can get the capital that they need to cover that misjudgment from the shareholders or from the capital markets, which are not available to directors of a mutual. So the directors of a mutual are always going to be far more worried about how much capital they've got and whether they've got enough under any circumstance. And, you know, I'd just be interested in what you have to say about that.
Yeah, I think the downside risk is a lot greater for a mutual. That's absolutely correct, and that's why they tend to be conservative and accumulate capital. But my point is that is also confers a the word I use, I think, is assertive benefit. There's a defensive reason for holding capital, and mutuals tend to be more careful because accessibility of capital is less. But on the other hand, the accumulation of capital in a mutual can be an assertive management tool, and it can be used constructively to further, if you wish to just further your financial objectives of cheaper or better value in a financial sense, insurance, sure. But I also do think that mutuals tend to they're more likely to make ex gratia payments and to engage in philanthropical sort of activities in the way they use their money. But that's not necessarily it's something that should be subject to market competition, in my view, because Eric Ranson's discussion before this one, we talked about the effect of protecting people unduly from risk tends to debilitate them in the long term by making them less able to look after themselves. And my father used to say, whenever there was a bushfire, he got very cranky about his dead and much a very conservative old man when he died. But he used to say that the government giving handouts to people that are not insured simply debilitates the population in the future. It's a moral hazard. It can increase the moral hazard. So, you know, there needs to be a market sanction on this too. So, I think mutuals do behave differently. in a variety of ways. And that's...
Jamie Reed, moving to a different part of your thoughts, Peter, you said that during your time in the industry, perhaps we've lost a company every couple of years.
Yeah.
Just wondering if you see any problem with that in particular. So would it be a problem if insurers, including mutuals, held so much capital that it was just unheard of for them to go bust? Or do you think there's a different responsibility for mutuals?
No, I think it's quite healthy that companies go out of business from time to time, and I think that's better than excessive regulation, if you like. And in the case of private health insurance, it's not been problematic. I don't think any insured person has actually lost from the process.
1968.
The last...
1968 was the last time people actually lost out.
Okay, well, Brent's been around even longer than me, Jamie, so, and he actually remembers. So I remember 1968, but not in the private health insurance industry. I was in Grosvenor Square in London protesting against the Vietnam War, which, but yeah, in the main, one of the things that FIAC has done has been to manage in an orderly way this process of people, of funds exiting the market in such a way that the members are protected. And the health insurance industry has done that quite well. And I think that is, I think the GFC has brought home the price of saving institutions that should not be saved, you know. It's a short-term benefit for a long-term cost. So, no, I don't have a problem with it at all. I don't think it should be excessive. But I also think that it's good for customers to know that they need to take some responsibility in their choice of where they put their business. I think that's a healthy thing too.
Peter Leary, thanks for your great presentation. Peter, I was just interested, in the paper, I think the paper shows fairly dramatically that for-profit health insurers hold less capital than mutuals, and I think you even go on to suggest a potential device as to how much of the additional capital that mutuals hold they can use in the assertive way. There's a factor K there, which I think is quite an interesting. But you don't go on, well, could you give us your thoughts about how much extra capital mutuals do actually need to keep, and should the regulators be recognising the access to capital for the lack of access to capital for mutuals?
Well, yes to the last bit, I do think that they're beginning to do this. I think the capital management planning is educating everybody. And I think it's a mutual journey, let me say, to use the term mutual in another sense. I think we're all travelling the same road together and all learning together. One of the things about this industry is it never stays the same. All the time I've been there, it's constantly changing and circumstances have changed. As to how much more capital, well, that's the question that the directors ask in the fund. I mean, how much should we accumulate? I mean, the general rule of thumb is that the 200% benchmark seems to be a sort of threshold that most people think is kind of appropriate. But I mean, it wouldn't bother me if they went to 300 or 400, if that's what they thought was in their competitive interest. The counter to that is that the only counter argument I've heard is that the government pays a rebate on premiums, and if these companies are forced to divest themselves of capital, there'll be a short-term gain to the Treasury in the somewhat slightly lower premiums in that fund that will result. But the price that they will pay, I mean, in an industry where capital can be invested at 8, 9, 10% or whatever, tax-free. It's not a bad place to accumulate capital. And I don't know whether that's the hurdle rate of the Treasury's rebate money, but probably not. But nevertheless, it's quite a substantial benefit. Comes in a mutual that does accumulate even more than that 200% of the whatever the regulatory threshold number is.
Well, perhaps using Chair's prerogative to ask a question. Peter, you did, I think there's a figure in the paper of 3.6, the ratio for mutuals, but there is quite a spread, as those in the industry would know, and some insurers have 8 or 10 or more times the required capital. It seems quite a lot. I wonder, sort of a controversial question, do you think that the Mutual Health Fund will survive our generation? We seem to have entered a new environment of acquire or be acquired. The bond that you talk about maybe isn't as strong as it once was, and if the members of a health fund are asked a direct question about the cash or the mutual, I don't know that the directors of a mutual can rely on members to vote in favour of the continuation of the mutual when presented with cashing out the estate. A for-profit insurer can go and raise capital in the capital markets to acquire another health fund. A mutual can't do it. Maybe some of this build-up of capital is a response to meeting some of that new environment.
Yeah, it's more a sociological than an actuarial question. But look, when the NRMA was being demutualised, I actually stood outside the head office of the NRMA on the street, getting people to sign a petition to get a general meeting going, which eventually did get going. Although the NRMA tried to close it down, I had to go to the Supreme Court in the end to force them. But they had the meeting. But it was very interesting. It's a bit like for an actuary to actually get on the battlefront and actually see real consumers and see what they think. And saying to people, will you sign this petition? It's about, the capital management issues in the NRMA, to cut a long story short. And there was a very clear demographic divide. I mean, the people that valued mutuality were very much older and more conservative and long-term members of this institution. They could tell you about what happened in the 1950s, and they'd been a member for 50 years and all this sort of stuff. It was very, very hard to get anyone under the age of 40 to take it seriously. They just wanted the money, and they just were going to take, we'll take the $2,000 and we'll get out of here. And one of the risks, of course, a mutual that accumulates capital runs is that it keeps changing that equation all the time. The current generation get even more money by cashing it out rather than keeping it going. So I think that, yes, it's very hard for mutuals to survive in this sort of postmodern world with, people who are less trusting of these social institutions and more focused on, market issues, as young people today seem to be, and less connected to the community in the way that perhaps older generations were. They're more mobile, they're more short-term in terms of, and they don't trust in institutions. Certainly not to the extent where they're prepared to leave $2,000 or $3,000 of their capital in that institution in the hope of getting some long-term benefit. So I do think mutuals have got a hard, hard road to hoe.
So I think we will have to make this the last question, and David's at the microphone.
David Watson, I sometimes wonder, Peter, whether you say things to provoke people into standing up in front of microphones.
Yes, I do.
I've just witnessed across the course of the last 12 months or so the dispute between NIB and GMHBA, and I'm very conscious that one observer, whose opinion I valued for many years and still do, said that the organisations that will survive in the longer term are the big ones, and the little ones that have got a very focused niche market or regional focus. Geelong's got a pretty strong regional focus. I knew that before I saw the events of the last 12 months. I notice it's moving a little bit away from capital and it's more about the conduct of the industry, but I'm very conscious that the software situation in the industry and the contracting situation in the industry and the actuarial and financial management regimes imposed by FEAC have collectively shored up and supported a lot of organisations that in a looser environment might have gone belly up, but they haven't. And they don't look like going belly up. And when you look at the solvency position in FEAC's annual report, they all look like they're pretty strong. Is it so wrong to let the organisations keep going the way they are?
No, not at all.
Maybe you want to make some comments about this, but I see that NIMB was very aggressive in trying to acquire GMHBA. GMHBA was very aggressive in defending its position and its membership, and very successful in doing that, from what I can see.
David, I'm not saying it ought to happen. I'm saying, being hard-nosed about it, I've seen how difficult it is to defend a mutual when people are waving money in front of the members' faces. And it's very hard to do. I mean, I was pleased that Geelong fought NIB off, not because I wanted either side to win, but because it was one for the little guys, as you say. And I do believe that mutuality, I hope it just survives until I'm gone in this particular market where I'm working, because I do think it makes it better for reasons that I said. But that's not just... 20 years ago, I was in favour of shareholder-driven funds getting into the health insurance market too, and I advocated that. But now I think the balance is pretty good, and that's what I would like to see if in my personal life stay.
Well, I think we're right out of time, so can I remind you to complete your feedback forms, and I'm going to nominate David Watson to collect them at the door before you leave. And can you please thank Peter for his presentation?